We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent.
Many people have seen ghosts and reported incredible experiences from the realm of the spirit world. Who can tell what this young man will see as he falls deep into a trance?
How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio, Friday night, May 15, 2015, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network, 2 hours, live every Friday night, 11 Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern, and we have a very, very exciting show for you here tonight. I am very happy today. We're going to be joined in about a half hour by a very special guest. His name is Dick Russell. And he has written books about everything. And my producer, Andrew Ludsky of our Facebook page, sent me a giant list of potential guests. And one of them was Dick Russell. And Dick Russell has written several books with Jesse the Body Ventura. I guess Jesse the Body Ventura was his wrestling name. But he's Jesse Ventura, the former governor. And of course, conspiracy theorist extraordinaire Jesse Ventura, and they wrote a book about the JFK assassination. And I thought, okay, it's a perfect fit for this show. Everyone likes hearing about the JFK assassination. We'll talk to Dick Russell about that. So contacted Dick, and he said, yeah, let's do the show. And I'd really like, he said, if we could talk about my other book, My Mysterious Son, A Life-Changing Passage Between Schizophrenia and Shamanism. His son was diagnosed with schizophrenia when he was a teenager, and Dick Russell spent much of his life dealing with this, looking for alternative therapies, trying to find ways to make life easier for himself and his son. He wrote a very interesting book, and in the course of writing it, he found a lot of parallels between shamanism and not just shamanism, but some of the great writers and artists and seers in history, a tie-in between that and schizophrenia. It's a very, very interesting book. I've been reading it. And so I thought, wow, that's two topics for one show. How interesting. And then I was talking to my wife about this, just brought up that I was going to have this guy on because I bought the books on the Kindle. I was getting ready to read them. And as I'm going through his Amazon Kindle, his list of books at Amazon.com, I came across a book called, I believe it's The Eye of the Whale. And as soon as I said that, my wife thought, I knew that name sounded familiar. I've got that book. And in fact, as I've mentioned before on this program, my wife runs a nonprofit called Whale Scout. And if you'd like to hear more, you can go to whalescout.org. And Dick Russell has written a book about the friendly whales of Baja, Mexico. And my wife, just a month ago, returned from Baja, Mexico, where she hung out and petted and played with these friendly whales. And I am by no means a whale expert, don't get me wrong. But because my wife is, I know a fair amount about it. And so that was a third talking point for the show. It's very, very interesting, by the way, the very, very friendly whales of Baja. We're going to talk about that for a little while. Then we'll jump into the JFK assassination. We'll talk about shamanism, schizophrenia. It is a fascinating interview coming up in about a half hour with Dick Russell, a man who could talk about anything. If I had my way, I would have talked to him for 6 hours, but there is, of course, a time limit, even on a radio show such as this. But I really think you're going to enjoy the interview with Dick Russell, which is coming up here in about a half an hour. We're also going to be taking your open line phone calls. Phone lines are not open yet. I will open those up in a little while, but for now, you can write down the number. It is 855-478-4478, toll-free in the U.S. and Canada. That is 855-478-4478. Lines are not open yet, but they will be soon. We also have two other phone numbers. If you are west of the Rocky Mountains, 425-488-0525. If you are east of the Rockies, it is 425-482-1686. If you want to send me an email tonight, my email address is Brian. It's Brian with a Y at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. I am up on Twitter at Brian Alvarez. The Facebook page, Facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow. My buddy Andrew runs that page. He's also the producer. So if you like us on Facebook at Facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow, you can message Andrew. And maybe you've got a guest request. Maybe you think you'd be a great guest for this program. Contact Andrew and he'll put you in touch with me, and we'll see what we can do about setting up a show. Also on the website, AfterDarkRadioShow.com, if you did not see it, you can download the May 8th show, which features an interview with Carl Stern, the original co-host of this program. And the two of us talk the Roswell slides and so much more. It is a free download right now at AfterDarkRadioShow.com, so run up there and grab it. Because as soon as this live program ends, this show will replace that free download. So this is pretty much, in the next 2 hours, your last chance to grab it. After that, the shows are gone, and the only way you can access them is as a subscriber to my main website, WrestlingObserver.com. Every episode ever of After Dark Radio is archived there for subscribers. It is WrestlingObserver.com if you want to check that out. Got a lot of news to get into here today. Obviously, Art Bell is scheduled to be kicking off his show here on the Dark Matter Digital Network in 65 days, 21 hours, 52 minutes, and 22 seconds. I know that because there's a countdown clock at artbell.com. Not a lot of new updates on the situation other than things are ongoing. More equipment is being delivered to both Keith Rowland and Art Bell. Obviously, they're in the process of getting the show ready, booking guests, trying to get advertisers. As we mentioned last week, the show will be airing on shortwave radio, in addition to worldwide, absolutely free on the internet. Every evening from 9 to midnight Pacific time, midnight to 3 a.m. Eastern, you'll be able to listen to Art Bell live and free. No matter where you are in the world, if you can get the Dark Matter Radio Network, which means if you can get on the internet, you will be able to hear Art Bell's new show, Midnight in the Desert. The shows will be available for download for, I believe, a $5 monthly subscription fee. Details on that will be available after a while, so if you can't stay up that late, or maybe you often fall asleep listening to Art and you want to hear the whole show the next day, subscription will be for you. If you go to artbell.com, there is a new frequently asked questions section. So for those of you that want to know, how can I listen to it? Is Art going to be on any terrestrial radio stations? Can I listen via podcast? Will the show be on shortwave or satellite? Can I call into the show via Skype? All of these questions are answered up at artbell.com. So head up there and check that out. Phone lines are open right now, 855-478-4478. All of the phone numbers are available at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We're going to go to the phones here in just a moment. But first, since we talked about it last week, the mystery of the Roswell slides has been definitively solved. If you listened to last week's show, Carl and I discussed everything, and I had a lot of theories about it. I presumed it was a mummy. I presumed that at some point we would discover where the museum was that this mummy was photographed in. And I'm going to read to you a little bit here from Kevin Randall's blog, which you can find at kevinrandall.blogspot.co.uk, which does a pretty good job summing up the mystery of the Roswell slides. We're only 10 days removed from the official unveiling of the slides. And it is 2015, everybody. And the reality of the situation was, with the power of the internet and social media and technology, the reality was, if this was not an alien, if this was a mummy, a mummified child or whatever, it was only going to be a matter of time before the mystery was solved. And in fact, it was just a matter of days. Kevin here writes, several days ago, a group of skeptical researchers applied a program called Smart Deblur to the placard found juxtaposed near the being pictured in the Roswell slides from 1947, thought to be of an extraterrestrial creature found crashed near Roswell. The author championed the slides as those of an alien, and this author was wrong. The group of skeptical researchers interpreted the placard as reading, "Mummified body of two-year-old boy. At the time of burial, the body was clothed in a cotton shirt. Burial wraps consisted of these small cotton blankets loaned by Mr. Somebody of San Francisco, California." And the key to this is that if you get the Smart Deblur program and you program it correctly and you put in the photograph that has been circulating around the internet, you will in fact be able to do this exact same interpretation for yourself. It is not something that only the researchers discovered. They did discover it, but anybody can do it if you've got the Smart Deblur program, and that is in fact what the placard says. And Kevin also says, working with a colleague from Europe, and with the text of the deblurred placard, I discovered last night that this interpretation of the text was correct. Found in the September 1938 Volume 8, Number 1, Mesa Verde Notes, that was published by the National Park Service, was an article that definitively solves the mystery of the Roswell slides. In paragraph 4 of the section of the publication entitled Around the Mesa, was found this, quote, "A splendid mummy was received by the Park Museum recently when Mr. S.L. Palmer Jr. of San Francisco returned one that his father had taken from the ruins in 1894. The mummy is that of a two-year-old boy and is in an excellent state of preservation. At the time of burial, the body was clad in a slip-over cotton shirt and three small cotton blankets. Fragments of these are still on the mummy." And he's included a link, which you can find at kevinrandall.blogspot.co.uk, to the article itself so you can read it. And as noted, the paragraph corresponds directly to the slides placard. The mummified body of a two-year-old boy, three small cotton blankets, and Mr. XXXX of San Francisco, California. It is the same boy. It is a mummy. It is a placard that reads exactly that. There is a second source for all of this information. It is definitive. The Roswell slides were, in fact, photographs of the mummy of a two-year-old boy. And Kevin Randall also here has offered his sincerest and deepest apologies to the Native American people of the Southwest United States. One of their children, a dead child from well over a century ago, was made into a spectacle. Whoever you are, you deserve to be extended dignity and respect. Your people, the ancestral Pueblans, honored you by preserving you. I played part, Kevin says, in disturbing your eternal rest, and for that I am so very sorry. Though I did not seek nor receive any money from any of this saga, and though my efforts were sincere and my offense unintentional, I am making a substantial donation to an American Indian children's charity and encourage everyone else who played part to do the same. That is from Kevin Randall at his blog. And the mystery of the Roswell slides is now officially over. To the phones, you are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
This is not Ryan from Cumberland.
Oh, my God. Shocking.
This is Ed from Cleveland.
What's up, Ed?
I heard earlier on Observer Live that you were going to be talking about JFK, the conspiracy.
That's right.
I am actually named after JFK. My real name is John, and my dad actually wanted my middle name to be Fitzgerald, and I was born I was born November 22nd, 1983.
Wow, 20 years to the day.
Yep.
How about that? So what did you get for a middle name?
Ed.
had
Cleveland.
Your dad very much wanted you to be Fitzgerald, and your mom just put her foot down?
Right. They wanted, yeah. She was like, nah, John Fitzgerald's a little too much.
How about that?
But instead, I get some crooked John Edwards and John.
So they
Edwards
named you after Ed in San Antonio. That's much worse.
Yes. Even worse. But yeah, I find the conspiracy theories to be very entertaining. I myself am an atheist, and I find this kind of stuff to almost be like my fun little like religion-ish thing, not like something that's a mythical thing that I can find fun and entertaining.
So do you believe in a conspiracy, or are you just entertained by the stories and you think that the official story is what happened?
I think that there are so many out there, and there's so much against him, or so much people that he ticked off, that I think that there is something that happened that wasn't just the Lee Harvey Oswald story, and that the Warren Commission was just all whack anyways.
And what did your father think of this assassination story?
I have no clue because I was 4 when he passed away, so I have no clue. My mom likes entertainment, so I always found it interesting. It was always something like I remember seeing on like Unsolved Mysteries and stuff. So that's where I first heard about it. Now I watch all the documentaries. If there's ever something on like History Channel, I'll watch it because I just find it to be fun.
Well, I don't know if it's true, but I read somewhere that it is the most written about event in human history.
Yeah.
Which is crazy when you think about it.
I also think that JFK was the last legitimate president, almost, in a way. Like, that he, besides being with the mob and all that kind of stuff, the last, like, non-corporate kind of president stuff. And a lot of people seem to take that up. I was a history major for a good amount of my collegiate time, and that was always a thing that was passed around, that he was the last one that was, like, voted in there pure legit. So,
well, I hope you enjoyed the interview tonight, and I'm sure it will not be the last time we talk about JFK. I want to thank you so much for the call. Apologies for being named after Ed in San Antonio. It wasn't my doing. To the phones, you are on the air. Who is this, and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is David from Baltimore, Maryland.
Oh, David, you called back after your investigation that you had promised last week.
Yes, sir. I have a full report. I sent you some photos earlier and some of the video I took on site.
I am looking at the video. I'm sorry, the images right now. I'm not going to load up the video yet because I'll probably get something crazy that starts playing here, but the photographs, these are awesome photos, by the way. I'm going to tweet.
Thank you.
I'll retweet this out to everybody. So what happened?
So I went there twice, as you recommended. The first time it was just around sundown. One of the traditional legends at this supposedly haunted cemetery is that there's a witch's Sabbath. A bunch of like ghosts and ghouls gather around some of the statues just around that time, and suffice it to say, I didn't see any green ghouls or anything like that.
Well, that's disappointing.
But that was just, you know, at sundown. And I got some really nice pictures, and, you know, no one bothered me or anything. So if you're in the area, definitely check out Druidred Cemetery. But the first statue I examined was the Clothanona one, the one that's the really scary one that's still there. It's the one that cuts you with its shears. Very, very scary. But I looked around, and when I came back that night, it was creepy because the detail on the statue is so much that I thought someone had just was sitting right there. See, what people don't realize in a cemetery is it's really, really dark. There's no street lamps, there's no stoplights, and it's just really, really isolated from everything. So, you know, pretty creepy, but no, I went back at midnight, just as the legend said. I did the Bloody Mary style incantation.
Wow, that's bold.
I don't want to get too personal, but Friday was my 23rd birthday, so I figured why not? This is the time to do something young and dumb. But I think aside from scaring away a few deer, I didn't really hear much. There's a lot of foxes in the area, I noticed. There's a lot of groundhogs, too. So maybe what people were, you know, hearing over time, all those decades, were just like sounds of the hunt, foxes.
I've tweeted both of these out, by the way. If you go to my Twitter, at Brian Alvarez, you can get the video and the pictures here if you want to check them out. And so no ghosts, no doom, nothing.
No, I also think I figured out why the Agnes statue, the one that isn't there, but the memorial is still pretty barren. They haven't commissioned a statue to replace it or anything. I guess they're afraid that, you know, the folkloric element in the town will take over and people will begin sacrificing things to this one. So it's pretty bare, but there's indications of the actual statue still, like, parts on the cement where you can see the statue used to stand, and there's still no grass growing by there, but that's possibly just due to the fact that there are so many people walking up and taking pictures of it, just trampling the grass underfoot.
So you also on Twitter mentioned that you are going to go on a new mission.
Yes, yes. I love After Dark Radio. You guys are just the best, and I really think that everyone who listens to your other radio shows should listen to this, and especially if you're just someone new who's tuning in, like, look up the host, Brian Alvarez, and, you know, listen to some of his other stuff. But my mission for next week is something to do, again, locally. So I've received some suggestions, actually, from the Paranormal Underground, some places I should check out. So I'm still mulling over my options, but there is a Henryton... what is this? Tuberculosis asylum. Very scary.
That's a good one.
Apparently the first two floors are just covered in graffiti, so it would make some nice pictures, but unfortunately this is an auditory medium and not a visual one.
And you also...
There's also some really...
You also mentioned skinwalkers, creepy woods behind your house, and Poe in Baltimore. What are these?
Okay, so behind my house, there's like this creepy little wooded area that has just always sketched me out since I was a kid. And deer are always going to and fro, and I think like most of my area uses it as a dumping ground, so I hope I don't find any mob remains. But it'll probably be like a really creepy sewer or something.
Well, as long as when the deer go in, they still come out, I think you'll be okay.
Well, yeah, yeah. But what's really funny is the sewer drains into a river called the Slaughter Branch. Enticing.
Wow.
There's also a Poe in Baltimore, Edgar Allan Poe, master of the macabre. He actually spent his last moments on this earth on Sol's Point in Baltimore. So there's this like little death tour you can go to. And I've been to the cemetery. It's right across from the VFW. And this cemetery is one of the few ones in Baltimore to still have catacombs. So creepy, creepy, creepy.
And
as for skinwalkers.
Yeah, we got to talk about these skinwalkers because I don't know a lot about them, but I did read a book about the Skinwalker Ranch, and these apparently are not to be messed with.
Yeah, these are probably the only things that really terrify me. And what's great is right across from my house is, it's in my city, it's known as Indian Country because all the streets are named after Indian tribes like the Iroquois, the Navajo, things like that. So I figure I go to a crossroads, say a couple words, some incantations, bad stuff, though. To the uninitiated, if you guys don't know what a skinwalker is, picture a werewolf that can not only, you know, mess you up like a werewolf, but it can take on the form of your loved one. So you'll be like talking to your dad or something, and then boom, razor claws, dead. But unlike most bestial savage werewolves that you can kind of, you know, deal with because even though they're pack hunters, they're still animals, skinwalkers have this canny intelligence. See, it takes a really, really bad, usually native shaman, but of course with everything with folklore, it's kind of transcended race almost in 2015. But generally you have to have some connection to the Native American culture or something, and you have to be like a witch or cursed, and these things are just... Picture everything bad that witches and hags can do, and vampires, kind of, and werewolves. So, not a fun time.
No, if it were me, that would be at the bottom of my list of potential investigations, at least on week two.
Yeah.
Maybe that'd be the main event after you've built it up for a while.
Exactly. There's also the supposed most haunted city in the Eastern Seaboard, Ellicott City. They actually had to rename it from, I think it was called Lynchburg or something. Very creepy. But there's a couple houses that I can stay in overnight and you record some EVP, do some basic investigation.
So you're really into this. You're doing overnight stays for these investigations.
I like to consider myself an unofficial intern for After Dark, if that's okay.
Well, I will give you unofficial intern status for this program here.
All right, or investigative reporter. But I can definitely, there's all sorts of like kitschy black magic shops and things in this kind of sketchy area called, well, it's not that sketchy. It's just like very bohemian. And I could like interview a couple people and make an actual news report. But there's also some sacrificial standing stones, the location that's been revealed to me. So yeah, I'm just going to try to put something together for next week for you guys. Skinwalkers, there's definitely a dangerous allure there, but I think I should be okay. But that's probably the easiest one because I could just walk over and do it.
Well, hey, if you did the incantations at the foot of these statues this week and nothing happened, I think you may be okay with the skinwalkers. But again,
yeah,
if I don't hear from you next week, I'm going to be worried.
Absolutely, Brian. I'll do my best to come back in one piece.
Listen, I want to thank you very much for the investigative reporting. I followed you on Twitter, as everybody else can as well. Head over to my Twitter, at Brian Alvarez, and you can check out the photos and the video as well from that investigation. And hopefully we get a report next week on the skinwalkers and nothing goes awry. 855-478-4478 is the phone number. That is 855-478-4478. We'll take calls for a little bit longer here, and then we will be joined by Dick Russell talking JFK, as well as a number of other very interesting topics as well. I am very excited about that. And don't forget, Brian at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. If you want to contact me there, as well as on Twitter at Brian Alvarez, I will be looking through these tweets throughout the evening here tonight. Want to mention this article, which kind of ties into what we're going to be talking about tonight. This from the epictimes.com, exploring the link between autism and anomalous experiences. This plays into the schizophrenia tie-in that Dick Russell is going to be talking about tonight. In his book, The Soul of Autism, author Bill Stillman provides dozens of examples of people with an autism spectrum disorder who have had a spiritual, psychical, I presume that means in or regards to psychic powers, or anomalous experience. Call it what you will. Stillman, who himself has Asperger's syndrome, writes about these perceptions with a firsthand knowledge. Another author with an autism spectrum disorder, an ASD, Donna Williams, has recounted her own psychic experiences, connecting them with sensory sensitivity and thin boundaries. Even among savants, who make up about 10% of the percentage of people with ASD, anomalous perceptions are not unknown. A large-scale study of child savants in the 1970s turned up a few whose parents reported that their son or daughter had ESP. A more recent cataloging by savant expert Dr. Daryl Treffert indicates a similar smattering of cases. It says here that accumulating evidence suggests people with an ASD, or for that matter, it says, a sensory processing disorder, are from an early age bombarded by sensory input that they have trouble discriminating. Their boundaries, we might say, are thinner than those of other people for whom the distinction between outer and inner is more constant, more firm. But even among individuals living with such a condition, there is a spectrum between high-functioning and low-functioning forms. People with high-functioning forms of ASD or SPD will have somewhat thicker boundaries and a more fully delineated conception of self. People with low-functioning forms will be more likely to withdraw into their own world, disassociate from feelings and sensations that become overwhelming, and become less engaged and communicative. This is going to tie into what we're going to talk about here tonight, which is that throughout history, there have been people that have seen what others have not seen. They have heard what others have not heard. They have become shamans. They have become oracles, whatever the word might be. and perhaps they were suffering from what today we would give people medication for. And perhaps they had a way of seeing things and teaching things that there is a theory, in fact, that great leaps in human history occurred as a result of people taking mind-expanding drugs. And perhaps there were people who had disorders, what we would today call disorders, who were in reality people that helped spur things along with their creative thinking and their prophecies and whatever else. We're going to talk about that on the show tonight with Dick Russell, as well as JFK. This interview was taped earlier on today. And if you want to check this article out that I just wrote about here, you can check out theepictimes.com. There are a number of different examples in here of people with these disorders seeing very, very, and hearing very, very interesting things. A number of very famous names brought up, and it's a very interesting article. But for the moment, it is time for today's interview. We're going to be joined by Dick Russell. You can check out all of his books at Amazon.com. He's written a ton of them. On the Trail of the JFK Assassins, Eye of the Whale, Striper Wars, An American Fish Story, The Man Who Knew Too Much, Hired to Kill Oswald and Prevent the Assassination of JFK, and a number of books with Jesse Ventura. He was a co-author on American Conspiracies, as well as Don't Start the Revolution Without Me. He's a very, very interesting guy. He can talk about anything. And we're going to kick it off here in just a moment. Dick Russell here on After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Very happy today to be joined by Dick Russell, author and environmental journalist. It says here at dickrussell.org, also the author of a number of different books. And Dick, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Brian. Good to be with you.
I am really excited for today because my producer put me in touch with you because we were going to do a show talking about the JFK assassination. And right. You mentioned that you had done another book as well, My Mysterious Son, A Life-Changing Passage Between Schizophrenia and Shamanism, which I have also started reading, in fact. And it was especially interesting because I was talking to my wife last night about you being on the show, and she said, God, that name sounds familiar. And it turns out that you have also written a book called Eye of the Whale, Epic Passage from Baja to Siberia.
That's correct.
She runs a nonprofit called Whale Scout here in Seattle. She just got back from Baja. She has your book. And she's mad that you're not on her podcast, so we may have to set that up.
We might have to. Well, that'd be great. Yeah, that was a book I did on the friendly gray whales back in, I guess, 10 years ago now.
Yeah, let's start by talking a little bit about that, because I know a little bit about it. Not as much as she does, obviously, but she was there. Baja, there is a lagoon.
Correct.
And a lot of tourists go there every year, and the gray whales are as friendly as can be. They come up to your boat. You hang over the edge. You kiss the whales. For a lot of people, it's a completely life-changing experience.
It is. It's in the wild. I mean, there's nothing like it on planet Earth, I guarantee you. I went there in 1998 to write a story about this industrial salt works that Mitsubishi and the Mexican government were planning to build on this site of this pristine lagoon, and while there, we went out, with my wife and a couple of friends. We went out on the water, and what was marvelous was that, you know, they're very tightly regulated. I mean, they don't allow tons of people out at one time, but these small pangas hold 9 people. They're called pangas, little boats, and you go out there, and we were just mesmerized. I mean, these whales were just coming up to us, and after the mothers had been there to give birth, and then they were coming up and introducing their babies. I mean, it was truly incredible. And I just, from that, decided I really need to write a book about these amazing animals, and ended up eventually finding that on that trip, the guy who had the first experience, the first close encounter, really, with these whales in the lagoon back in the 1970s. He was a fisherman, and back in those days, they thought the gray whales were, they called them the devil fish, that they would overturn your boat. because they'd been hunted almost to extinction in this same lagoon. So suddenly they're approaching this fisherman, and he was terrified. And I remember he told me, it was Pachico Mayoral, he's dead now, but he said he doesn't know what it was that compelled him to put his hand out, and he touched this whale, and something happened mysteriously in that moment where the whales then began coming up to people in the lagoon, and so it's truly magical, and I did write a very large book as I tend to do, called Eye of the Whale for Simon and Schuster, and follow their migration all the way from Baja to Russia where they feed.
You know, it wasn't in Baja, but it was only a couple of months ago that there apparently was an incident somewhere where there was a whale down in Mexico that breached, and it actually landed on a boat, and yep. I think some people were killed, which is very rare.
Very rare. One person, I believe, was killed. I heard about it. And, you know, all I can think is, I mean, this is an anomaly. It's very strange that this would happen. And so I don't know. It seems like maybe it was a bigger boat. It wasn't just a little panga, and it was you know, maybe the guy who was running the boat got too close, or something strange must have happened. I don't know what, but that's really something that the gray whales don't do, and is coming to overturn people's boats anymore. So somebody had bad karma. I don't know, but something happened.
Yeah, now the whales, these gray whales, they migrate from Baja all the way north, all the way up the coast, all the way up to Siberia.
Right.
It's a very long trek, and I'm certainly not an expert about this, but I know that there is some controversy around here. The Macaw Indian tribe wants permission to hunt a small number of gray whales, and obviously there have been times in the past where gray whales have been hunted. And yep. I guess one of the questions I have for you is, I mean, it would appear that the whales would have to know that in certain areas you got to stay away from people, or at least they have in the past. And they certainly don't feel that way in Baja. I guess you'd be the person to ask here. I mean, does it appear that the whales are cognizant of certain areas it being safe to hang around people, and other areas maybe it's not so safe?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, they're certainly very intelligent. But in Baja, they were hunted and almost hunted to extinction back in the 19th century. So in the same lagoon where they were slaughtered, they're suddenly coming up to people. But it was as if it was a gesture of, I don't know, you know, some kind of, I don't want to anthropomorphize it too much, but it's like, We can have a relationship, and they were very forgiving, obviously, to human beings who almost killed them. The macaw thing is a whole other matter, and frankly, I think it's ridiculous. I mean, they hunted whales at the beginning of the century, the last century. It was part of their native tradition, but hadn't been for a long time, and, you know, it was kind of money-making publicity thing. I think the Japanese urged them to do it because the Japanese want to keep on doing their, quote, scientific whaling over there. And I went there. The macaw story is very much a part of the book, too. And now they did kill a whale in 1999, I believe it was, with a crew going out with a harpoon, and, you know, they're widely covered by the media and everything. And now they want to do it again. So. But there's no reason for it, really. I mean, it's not some, you know, this is not some Native tradition or Native American tradition that's been pursued actively over the years. It's like reviving something that should have been and was ended long ago.
I think there was one legal hunt, like 98 and 99, and I think there was one illegal hunt in the middle part of the 21st century, like 2006, 2007 or something.
Yeah, there was. I think because they were not allowed to do it, and they went out and defied the authorities and decided to do it anyway. I don't recall if they killed a whale then or not. They might have. But anyway, I spent some time on the reservation, and it's not even that the whole reservation, Macaw people were supportive of this. Certainly one of the tribal elders, Alberta Thompson, was leading a big movement within her tribe and outside it to not allow this to happen. Now, she'd been someone who had been to Baja and had this marvelous experience with the friendly gray whales. They'd come up to her, and she'd touched them, and she knew it was really wrong to for her people to hunt this amazing creature.
So you have written a number of books, and we're here talking about whales. You've also written a book about the fight to save the Atlantic striped bass. You've written books with Jesse Ventura about the JFK assassination. You've got the new one, which we're going to talk about. Your son's life-changing passage between schizophrenia and shamanism is the name of the book. These are all available on Amazon.com. I guess as an author, do you sort of, because you're a great writer, it's just sort of, this gives me an opportunity to examine different things in my life that interest me at any given time?
I'd say that's really true. I mean, I have a lot of interests, from the environment to who really killed President Kennedy. I was a teenager at the time in high school and believe the truth has never been told about that. And then I, as far as Jesse Ventura, I happened to run into him in Mexico, where I was doing some writing in the winter.
He was living there, right?
Yeah, he has a place down there and still has it. And this was after he was governor of Minnesota and after he'd been a Harvard fellow and an MSNBC commentator. And so we ran into each other, and he'd read my JFK book, The Man Who Knew Too Much, and liked it. And anyway, he said, well, if you're going to be back here next year, this was 10 years ago now, I guess, maybe we can work on my memoir together. And we did, and then we proceeded to do four other books for Skyhorse Publishing, American Conspiracies and 63 Documents the Government Doesn't Want You to Read. They were huge bestsellers. And Ventura's, he's a great showman, as people know. I mean, he can get out there and promote a book. And for me, it was an opportunity. I like the man. I don't agree with him on everything politically, but he's very bright and very creative and a thinker. And this gave me a chance to, my name is on the book too, so I'm not just a ghostwriter, but, you know, I did a lot of putting these together before he would read them and gave me a chance to say some things about the secret history of our country that I want to see out there in the public.
This is my secondary job here, this After Dark show. My main job is I do a radio show about pro wrestling. And so I am well aware of Jesse Ventura and his life prior to being the governor of Minnesota. And yes, a great showman, legendary showman, really. But he is, as you noted, a very passionate fella. Yeah. I just finished They Killed Our President, 63 Reasons to Believe There Was a Conspiracy to Assassinate JFK. And I don't know where I saw this, but I saw something about you. And it was in regards to you and JFK, and it said something like, you believe in the possibility of a conspiracy to assassinate JFK. And if you read the book, I mean, Jesse Ventura, there is no possibility here. He believes without a shadow of a doubt that this man was assassinated as a result of a vast conspiracy.
Well, I certainly believe there was a conspiracy, too, not just a possibility, but that's what happened. And I don't, maybe they were referring to the fact that I don't know necessarily how vast it was, and I don't think anybody knows, but, you know, you can point fingers in a lot of different directions, and I think it's become more and more clear over the years that certainly the mafia or the mob had a hand in it. I don't say they pulled it off. I don't think they could have orchestrated the cover-up that ensued, and that Cuban exiles, anti-Castro Cubans were involved, and the elements of the CIA and right-wing oil people and Pentagon people probably, but I don't go so far as to say that it was, you know, the Joint Chiefs of Staff or some, you know, somebody at a high level pulling it off. Although I'm going to be open-minded about it because my friend David Talbot, who wrote the book Brothers about the Kennedy brothers and Bobby's investigation into who killed his brother before he was himself assassinated in 1968. David's coming out with a book this fall on Alan Dulles that is going to point the finger at him and he was head of the CIA before Kennedy dumped him after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion. And David's going to point a pretty strong finger at Dulles as perhaps having been a mastermind behind JFK's murder.
You know, I'm by no means an expert in the JFK assassination, but I've been reading about it for God knows how many years, and I may have read so much about it that I'm even more confused, but it seems that every time there's a new book out that argues for a conspiracy, you read it, and when the book is done, you're like, man, I mean, there had to have been a conspiracy. I mean, there's so much evidence for. And then another book will come out that is an anti-conspiracy book, and they will do a really, really good job taking apart all of the supposed conspiracy theories. And you're left thinking, man, it's exactly as they've always told us. It was Oswald the Lone Nut. And then another book comes out about a conspiracy, and they poke holes in that book. And it just seems to go back and forth, back and forth. But to me, when it comes to a conspiracy like this, if you can find one indisputable fact that proves there was a conspiracy, I mean, that should be it, right? It's not like in terms of like debunking, you can try and debunk all of these theories, but I think in the book it said something about how there was one bullet hole that was 6 millimeters wide, but the bullet itself would have been 6.5 millimeters. So how could a bullet go through a hole that's smaller than the bullet itself? I believe I may have gotten that wrong, but
yeah, there's all kinds of things about the physical evidence.
Yeah, if that's true, I mean, it had to be a conspiracy. There's no other answer.
Yeah, and the fact that all of the, you know, the doctors at Parkland Hospital where JFK was taken after he was shot, you know, they all saw basically what had to be an entry wound in his head, which means, of course, there was a shot fired from the front. They weren't all fired from the rear by Oswald. And, you know, then this was all fudged and changed at the botched autopsy in Washington, D.C. And, you know, and the Zapruder film was altered. I mean, there are so many. There's also the fact that how does this lone marksman who wasn't even that good a shot, Oswald, fire, what was it, three shots in 6.2 seconds with a cheap Italian rifle, and which may not even have been found on that floor. I mean, you know, there's some very, very direct, hard evidence in those kinds of physical evidence characteristics that say that there had to have been more than one gunman. So if there was, as the House Assassinations Committee concluded back in the 1970s, when they did their investigation, people forget that they came out and said, unlike the Warren Commission, they were the next official investigation, that this was a conspiracy, and that, you know, there had to be someone else shooting. So, you know, all these books that continue to come out upholding the Warren Commission are basically beating a very dead horse. I mean, it just wasn't that way. And the evidence, all of the key evidence points otherwise.
Let's look at a couple of these things in detail here. You mentioned the doctors. And to me, if you have a bunch of eyewitnesses, a bunch of doctors and people in the hospital who claim that there was an exit wound in the back of the head, mm-hmm. and then you've got as contrary evidence a few photographs.
Right.
Okay, so in any other investigation, anywhere in the world, if you had the actual doctor saying one thing and you had photos saying something else, most people would think, okay, photos can be doctored. But you've got all of these eyewitnesses that say otherwise. But because it's the Kennedy assassination and there's an official story, the photographs now hold more weight than what the actual doctors said.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, that's where it comes down in terms of people who support the Warren Commission. Yeah, but photos can and were doctored, and the physical part of it, I'm not an expert on all the physical autopsy stuff. I've interviewed lots of people who could point at who may have been behind this, but I know there are a lot of people who have studied this physical evidence in minute detail, and the president's brain was where the wounds were, and this was all changed at the autopsy, and they fudged it, and there's just no doubt about it, according to people who've really studied this, like Doug Horne of the Assassination Records Review Board, who wrote this, you know, 1,000-page book about all this physical evidence. So, people are going to... the argument will probably go on forever. I don't know that we're going to ultimately get to the bottom of who was behind this. I think there's been, as you say, you know, you read one book, it says one thing. There's been so much disinformation put out there, so much to mislead the public, to raise doubt in people's minds, just like, you know, is being raised today by the disinformation experts hired by the big oil companies about whether climate change is real. I mean, this is absurd. It is real. It's happening in front of our eyes. And yet the media ends up quoting, you know, the other side, the scientists, to say, well, there's still some doubt, la, la, la. 98% of the scientists say global warming is happening. So, but it's the same kind of scenario where the people in who have an axe to grind, who have a vested interest, want to put doubt on an issue. And that happened with the Kennedy assassination. It's still going on in things like climate change.
You know, whether you believe it is a conspiracy or not, I think one thing that is an indisputable fact is that there was so much about the investigation that was done so poorly.
Yeah.
That if everybody would have gone to trial, I mean, there is a chance that Oswald would not have been convicted. I mean, when you look at, some of this was done after he passed away. I mean, his body, when I guess there were like agents that went in there and they were, I guess they went in to where his body was. The doors were closed. When they came out, there was like ink on his hands. They'd like gotten fingerprints and that sort of thing. The fingerprints on the gun were not complete. And no. I mean, the chain of custody with the fingerprints and Oswald was all screwed up.
Yeah,
scrubbing the limo afterwards and JFK's body actually being taken from the hospital at gunpoint. All of these things.
Yeah, endless.
Yes. It just, to me, makes it, whether you believe in a conspiracy or not, if you think about the people who would have survived, I'm not sure who would have been convicted in all of this.
Oh, yeah, which, of course, is why Oswald was bumped off by Jack Ruby, you know, a couple days later. I mean, had he gone to trial, he would have named other people that he was obviously involved with, and they didn't want that to happen. And, sure, if he'd have gone to, I think there was some years ago, a mock trial done where he was definitely acquitted. I can't remember the details of it, but the Warren Commission, you know, I don't think, people say, well, the Warren Commission would never cover anything like this up because these were honorable people and da-da-da. My theory on this is that, yes, Earl Warren, he was the Supreme Court Chief Justice. He was a leading member of the Warren Commission. I have a feeling that they just chose not to look at certain things because they were probably told falsely that if you look too deep, here's this guy Oswald. He's been in Russia. He wanted to go to Cuba. Maybe he really did go. Hello, you there?
I'm here.
Okay. And so the communists are behind this, and then we're going to have World War III. Well, that was crap. But, you know, they might have sold the Warren Commission that bill of goods, and therefore they felt they were doing their patriotic duty to kind of, okay, we're just going to go with this guy who looks like he probably did it. And then you had Alan Dulles, the former director of the CIA, who hated Kennedy, sitting on the Warren Commission. You had Gerald Ford, who later became president, of course, who was a congressman from Michigan at the time, and he's an FBI informant, basically. I mean, he's reporting everything back to J. Edgar Hoover and that the Warren Commission is doing. And you did have dissenting voices, though. You had my namesake, Richard Russell, senator from Georgia. He knew there was something fishy about all this, and I think did a dissenting report without getting into detail about it, but it wasn't unanimous. But I think the Warren Commission may have had their own, sort of semi-honorable reasons for not looking beyond Oswald.
When talking about Oswald, I think that most people listening to this have, even if you don't really study the JFK assassination, you probably have heard some of the general details. Stories of the magic bullet and could he have fired 3 shots in 6 seconds or maybe even as many as 6 shots. Everybody's kind of heard the general sort of the common knowledge of this story. But one thing that I don't know if a lot of people have heard about, and I've heard about it, but I don't know a lot about it, and hopefully you can clear some of this up. The strange story of the possibility of there being 2 Oswalds.
Yeah. Well, it is a strange story. And, a fellow named John Armstrong has really documented a lot of this, and I've done a little bit of investigation into it, too, and I write about it in my second book, which is called On the Trail of the JFK Assassins, which sort of has a lot of things in it that I couldn't either fit in my first book or that I discovered since it came out earlier in 1992. One of those things I looked at was the 2 Oswald theory, and there's a lot of... there was apparently it was weird. I remember talking to, one thing that comes to mind immediately is talking to the former principal of the Dallas Junior High, where Oswald attended, and he said that right after the assassination, the FBI swept down on his school and took all the school records. And he told me that the Oswald that they picked up, was not the same one that attended that school. It seems like there was an intelligence operation being run with lookalikes. I mean, more than one. I mean, that's been well documented in the past with other instances. But you know, in the book JFK and the Unspeakable, there's an interview done with the people in the Texas theater where Oswald was arrested. And two of them said that there were two Oswalds in there, basically, that there was a lookalike. There were these two lookalikes, and one of them was arrested, and the other one went out the front door. So, I mean, why would these guys make this up? It seems like to me there was some kind of intelligence operation being run, probably from the time they were quite young, with these two people. Strange as it sounds.
It is such a strange story, and I'm looking here. Apparently there was, let's see, the trial of Lee Harvey Oswald, and the trial of Lee Harvey Oswald, there were two of them apparently, and a fictionalized one as well, On Trial Lee Harvey Oswald, films in 64 and 77, and then apparently either another film or something else in 1986. But I guess that's probably what you're talking about there. Unscripted testimony from surviving witnesses to the events. Verdict returned, it says here. I guess there were three of them. There's one returned a verdict of guilty. The American Bar Association did two trials. One ended in a hung jury. The other acquitted him. So there you go.
So there you go. Oh, and on this two Oswald thing, this was the other... I uncovered this in the course of my journalistic investigation back in 1976. I was interviewing a man named Frank Ellsworth, who was a Treasury Department agent who'd been that day gone into the jail and the book depository. I mean, he was one of the early people on the scene, and he told me an amazing story, which was that he had arrested a lookalike a few days before, who was a right-wing Minuteman type. Gun runner to the Cubans, and he said that when he walked into the jail and saw Oswald, he was himself scared because he thought he had just released the man who killed the president. Well, he hadn't. He'd released a guy who looked just like him. And there's so many reports of, his name was John Thomas Mason. I can say that because I revealed it at the time, and it's in my book. And I actually tracked down Mason, and I interviewed him in 1976, so this was like 13 years afterward. You could still see a resemblance. He was a gun shop owner in Dallas, and he did not want to talk to me. He was very, very nervous, and I remember him saying to me something that struck me, sort of struck to the quick, so to speak. He said, when you were going around interviewing people about all this, he said, you should realize that what might be a living to you could mean a life to them. I mean, the guy, he knew something, but he didn't talk about it. But that's just a personal example that I know directly of this, that there were impersonations of Oswald going on, and people would see him in one place. There was a lot of documentation about that, even by Richard Popkin in a book called The Second Oswald, written way back, that was weird. There was this guy who looked like Oswald on the rifle range, and there was another guy driving a car. He didn't drive. I mean, It's a fascinating aspect to all this, and I must say that John Armstrong, I think, has done some amazing research into this side of this really wild saga.
So I guess if you're looking at the theory that there were two Oswalds, are we presuming that one of them was the guy who would have been one of the shooters, and the other guy was one who was killed?
I don't know that we can presume that, although I think that we can presume that, yes, one of them was directly involved in shooting, or was certainly the one who was accused and held in custody and married to Marina and all of that. And the other one, who knows? Who knows what happened to him or exactly what kind of intelligence operation it was. But it was, the CIA did stuff like this using doubles And there were a lot of anti-Castro Cuban operations going on at the time. One of them could have been anti-Castro, one of them pro-Castro. I mean, you know, there's a lot we don't know, but I think the fact that there were likely to is fairly certain, at least in my view.
You can't really convict or acquit a guy based on whether his behavior was what one would expect or not, but there was a lot of weird behavior by Oswald in the hours after he allegedly shot the president. I mean, he insisted his innocence. I mean, yeah. he, and I guess not only just insisting that he was innocent, but there are records of him speaking very highly of the president. This is not like when somebody goes absolutely nuts and they go on a shooting rampage, and then of course you talk to people that said, oh, there were all these warning signs, he talked terribly about this or that, and everybody should have seen it coming. No, he talked very highly of the president. He denied that he did it. He, after allegedly shooting the police officer, he went to a movie. I mean, you could say he was hiding out, but you commit a crime like that and you go into a crowded movie theater, it's strange behavior. It's just a lot of weird things that happened right around that time period.
Yeah, I think he was likely in that movie theater, and the other one too, who went out the door. But he was there to meet a contact. Somebody was gonna you know, take him, spirit him out of this this scene. But instead, he was betrayed, or if you want to say use that word, you know, he was.
He did not hide when he was in the theater. He was.
No.
He made himself very visible.
Yeah, he did, and he said very clearly after he was arrested, "I'm a patsy," which means I'm being set up. So to take the rap, which he was, or at least certainly in terms of being the lone gunman, which, I mean, I don't, you know, he may have never fired a shot. He might have been on the second floor getting a Coke. I mean, there's a lot of evidence for that, too. So, but, you know, I think that my first book, The Man Who Knew Too Much, gets into this guy, Richard Nagel, that I knew, who knew Oswald and indicates pretty strongly that, you know, Hoover of the FBI, who hated Kennedy, knew enough to scuttle this whole plot 2 months beforehand, that the CIA was involved at a certain level. And so Nagel is long dead now. He died in 1996, but 95. But, you know, I spent a lot of time with him, and I saw enough of his backup evidence to believe that there was definitely a lot more to this than anybody'd ever admitted.
So apparently there was a poll that came out where 60% of Americans, this was just a couple of years ago, believe that there was a conspiracy.
Yeah,
within a couple of years, I believe there are some documents that will be released in 2017. I think there are some other documents that are going to be released around 2029. I mean, there's still stuff that is going to come out about this. And at some point, everybody involved in any way is going to be deceased.
Yeah.
Do you believe that in a younger person's lifetime, we're going to know what really happened here? Because once everybody involved has passed away, I mean, what would be the harm? If everybody involved has passed away, new generations have come, we're looking at what will be long ago in history, maybe even 100 years by the time everything comes out. I mean, do you think that at some point we'll know what really happened?
Shit. Excuse me. Dropped my phone, and my cat is fighting behind. I'm not trying to fight another cat behind me. no. I don't know. I would like to say yes, but I'm afraid that most of the strongest evidence has probably been deep-sixed, that we'll be able to put more pieces together as time perhaps goes on. I know that there's a lot of documentation about a particular CIA officer named Ioannidis that the CIA is stonewalling, releasing, and that Jefferson Morley, a former reporter for the Washington Post, is still trying very hard to get out of the government. And maybe once that comes out, we'll get a look at least who some of the Cuban exile connections were to this. And but I don't know. I'm not optimistic at this point because there's not that many people still living who probably, you know much about what happened. And I think it was designed to, you know, there was a lot of a lot of disinformation put out to muddy the waters, and I wish, I wish I could be more optimistic, but I'm not.
Now, we don't have to go into a lot of detail about any of this, but as somebody who has written extensively about this, are there other... I mean, I got a question. I got an email last week. Somebody said, what conspiracies do you believe in? And they just had this huge list of famous conspiracies in popular culture. And in looking at them, I mean, the vast majority of them, I took the road of what we've been told is likely very close to the truth. I mean, there's always something here, something there. But in general, I'm not a real big believer in conspiracies. Are there other conspiracies in popular culture that you side with the theorists as opposed to the general consensus?
The theorists being the ones who believe that there was a conspiracy, but
yes.
It's not shown?
Oh, yes.
Sure. I mean, I think, the Robert Kennedy assassination was a conspiracy. I mean, there's very clear evidence that there were many more bullets fired. There were, I think, 13 bullet holes found in the wall of the Ambassador Hotel, and Sirhan only had 8 bullets in his gun. I believe in that instance that Sirhan was probably part of the CIA's MKUltra or mind control program, which has been well documented, existed at that time, and may well have been hypnotized, acting under hypnosis when he went into the pantry. I think he doesn't remember to this day what really happened. You know, apparently he was given a signal by a woman in a polka dot dress and kind of triggered into a strange trance. I mean, I know this stuff sounds wild, but this was going on back then.
There were crazy things happening in the 60s.
Crazy. I mean, it was. So I my belief is that all the conspiracies all of the tragic deaths of the four leading figures of the 1960s, that Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and the Kennedy brothers, they were challenging the status quo. We would have a different country, a different world had they lived. And I think there's strong evidence in each case to show that it was much more than one gunman or one very small group involved.
On a totally different note here, you have also written a book, My Mysterious Son, A Life-Changing Passage Between Schizophrenia and Shamanism. And this came out in November of 2014, your newest book, I presume.
Yes, it is.
And already getting some very good reviews on Amazon.com. I started reading it yesterday, and I thought it was really interesting because I have never really seen anybody write so much about the possible tie-in between schizophrenia and shamanism. But when I was reading your the introduction to the book, and you were talking about some of the conclusions you've come to, it is very much similar to a lot of the things that I've kind of thought for a long time. Maybe not so much in terms of schizophrenia, but I believe that there are certain people who have a certain chemical makeup in their brain where they experience things that everybody else doesn't.
Right.
And maybe some people would call them crazy, or maybe some people, whatever people would call them. Really, there's maybe more to it than that, and perhaps it could tie into people who claim to see ghosts, people who claim to see UFOs, people who claim to have been abducted, visited. And so I was fascinating reading that chapter there, and obviously we can talk about some of that today. Tell us a little bit about this book.
Well, it was a very personal and painful in many ways book to write. I've never written a memoir. My son had a breakdown when he was 17. He's now 36. Was diagnosed by the hospital authorities as having light probable schizophrenia. The whole first part of the book is I call the desperate years. I mean, it was in and out of hospitals, on and off medication, and very, very tough period, obviously for him and for his parents too. But the second two-thirds of the book tells a different story, and part of it is my taking my son to East Africa. Franklin is his name, to East Africa in the beginning of 2012. My son is biracial, and I felt it would be meaningful to him to be in an all black culture. We went to Tanzania and had some real breakthrough moments there together as father and son. I mean, just very powerful stuff that happened that was very tough, but we got through it, and it changed the nature of our relationship. And I'd already been sensing for a long time that my son had very, what I would call, psychic abilities. I mean, he could, despite his sometimes so-called delusional thinking, he could also, you know, tune into things that I was thinking about and stuff that was going on, and it was like he was connected to this otherworldly reality that I wasn't. I didn't know quite what it was, and so in exploring alternatives or adjuncts anyway to medication, he is still on medication, but I don't think could function without it that well, at least at this point in his life. But you know, I began looking at, well, what else is there? What else could help him? And so I struck up a relationship with a man from West Africa named Maladoma Somme, who I had interviewed for another book. And I went to see Maladoma for what's called a divination, where he sort of, and I did it strictly about my son. You know, what does he see? And he assigned me some rituals to do. It had to do with ancestral stuff, and it was all new to me. I mean, I just dove into it, and I took my son to Jamaica to meet him personally, and Franklin did drawings for Maladoma the whole time, and they got along famously. And so it was very, the shaman, Maladoma, said to me afterwards, he said, you know, it was like meeting a colleague. I mean, they talked on this whole other level. And so I mean, this is a long story short, stop it. Excuse me, my cat is.
I got cats too. I know exactly where you're at.
So, but I wrote the book really to,
hey, get out of here.
Sorry about that.
I've experienced it many times.
I wrote the book really to give parents in similar situations a sense that, you know, there can be light at the end of many a dark tunnel, and there are different ways. There are alternatives to the conventional Western medication system that can exist and can be explored. And so, in that sense, it's a hopeful book. It's not just another story of, you know, that doesn't go anywhere. So, you know, and my son's doing very well today, much better than he has in a long time, and I don't think I will ever know really quite how that came about, because it's rather mysterious, as shamanism is. It's dealing with hidden and spiritual realities, certainly, that we don't have access to all the time. And you know, but it's an ongoing process, and I'm still involved with Maladoma, and we'll see where things go in the future.
It was interesting when you were writing about how, and you just talked about it there, the shaman felt that your son and himself were colleagues, and you write in the book about how it's interesting if you look back in history, and I've always kind of felt this way too, when you look back and you read the writings of certain people. To me, it's always kind of been, this is more than just your average creativity. I mean, this person had something going on. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was something they were born with. I don't know if it was some drug they were taking. But I mean, clearly, this is more than just your average creativity that has resulted in this level of writing and creativity. And you note in the book how it's interesting that for a long period in human history, it appears that individuals with schizophrenia or whatever it might be that causes these whatever the behavior might call, they were revered.
Yes.
And then there came a point in time where, I mean, you note like in the 50s and 40s and 50s, I think it was. I mean, if you had schizophrenia, it was lobotomy time. We drill holes in your head. I mean, this was in the modern era.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
in the supposed primitive era, there was like an attempt to find out, okay, this person is not like us, but what are their, what about them is positive? How can they help us? How is this like an innate talent that is a good thing? And I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, thank you. It is interesting. It's fascinating, actually. I mean, back in the, you know, early Plato used to speak of the divine madness. I mean, you know, the early philosophers and Pythagoras, you know, was considered to be insane and some by some because he, but then yet, you know, they were so in tune to creating a whole new, you know, geometry, mathematics, in fact, there's a book that I read by Julian Jaynes, who was a psychologist, and he speculated that, you know, in ancient times that there was a, he calls it a bicameral mind, that actually people, maybe almost everybody was what might be called today schizophrenic. I mean, people were receiving messages directly through one side of their brain that they said came from God. I mean, it was a whole different approach to what now we see as voices in the head, you know, that are crazy people. So it's really interesting to look back in history and see how this has changed over time and how there are parallels between the shamanic, which is still revered in indigenous cultures, many of them around the world, and how close some of those symptoms, you might even say, are to what is now being labeled someone who's schizophrenic. Now, I don't say this to dismiss the terrible difficulties that exist with mental illness, but the fact that there is another level to it that Western medicine often doesn't recognize, and that I think if parents could recognize that there is there's an element of genius often and certainly beauty to what seems to be simply tragic that's happening to their child, that there might be other ways to certainly other ways to look at so-called delusions. And you know, one thing that was very instrumental and helpful to me was advice I got from a psychologist who I wrote a biography of, named James Hillman, who said that, you know, just quit trying to change him. Stop trying to correct his behavior, which is what I was doing. You know, he'd say these outrageous things, and I'd, it can't be that. And once I did that, once I just accepted this, the way my son was for what it was, we could just kind of have fun together. And I didn't have this need to be so overly parental all the time.
Well, when you mention the idea that maybe at one point most people were schizophrenic, I mean, yeah. I'm sure at that time, if you were not, you would have been the one who they would be trying to change. You know what I mean? Like yeah. The idea of trying to make someone who is schizophrenic normal, I mean, to them, they're normal, and you're the weird one.
That's
and
correct.
Because the majority of us are quote normal, I mean, we're sitting here trying to change another person who, as noted, if there was a period in time where most people were like this, then that would be their goal. The goal would be what can we give this normal person, so to speak, to make yeah. them experience what we're experiencing as schizophrenics, which might be where all of this. I mean, my wife went to Peru during college, and there was a shaman, and they all took ayahuasca, and she had the same journey, and yeah. maybe where that's where all this began, an attempt to make what we today call a normal person into a person who would see what they saw.
Yeah, I think that's quite true. I mean, you know, I have a lot of my son's writings in the book from 10 years ago, a lot of them, and there's just sheer poetic genius in many of them. You know, I'm a professional writer and a journalist, but I mean, he's way beyond me in the kinds of things that he sees and is able to express, and true of his art too. I wish he would pursue these things full time, but you know, he doesn't choose to do that. He wants to be, as he says, a jack of all trades. But yeah, and you know, I can't not comment on the fact that, you know, since the late 80s, we've seen in this country a 50-fold increase in the sales of psychiatric drugs. You know, it's gone from $800 million to more than $40 billion. And, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is just getting rich off diagnoses of schizophrenia, bipolar, depression. You know, and it's extended now to children, which I think is really wrong. You know, that back in the late 80s there, I think there were 16,000 kids diagnosed with mental illness, and now it's more than 600,000. So they're slapping children at the age of, you know, 5, 7, 10 on so-called, you know, antipsychotic drugs, and which do have severe side effects over time. So, you know, the whole emphasis on Western medicine, which I bought into the whole thing, too. I mean, what are you going to do? You know, I mean, this is what the doctors are telling you. You got to be on these drugs. And otherwise, he's going to be in a hospital forever. You know, you do have to pay some attention to that. But I've discovered over the years that there's a whole other element. And I wish there were more situations where there were models where at one time where young people who had been diagnosed with these conditions could sit and really talk about this together, and a lot of them ended up going off medication, not having to go back on it once they were able to express these things that were going on inside their heads. So you know, there's no easy answers to it, and it's a catch-22 in a lot of cases. But a lot more needs to be done in terms of looking at ways to come up with how could one possibly recover with alternatives to psychotropic medication.
It's obviously going to be a controversial subject, but many people who have taken, whether it be ayahuasca or LSD or any other mind-altering substance, the official scientific word would be that you took something that caused your brain to give you these visions and these feelings that you had gone elsewhere.
Yep.
And there's also the other side of the coin where, in fact, you wrote about this in the book, where there were, I guess, and you can correct me if I screw this up, there were, I guess, shamans who people were able to perform surgery on them without any anesthetic or anything, because the shaman at the time was in an out-of-body state.
Mm-hmm.
And so the body was operated on while the shaman was out of their body. So,
right.
I obviously there is a school of thought that this is not something your mind is creating. When you go on these trips, you're going somewhere else. You're in another dimension. You're
yep.
in another plane of existence. And obviously that's very controversial. But in writing and documenting all of this and investigating it, what do you think happens when somebody enters one of these realms? Is it really entering a realm, or is it in their head?
No, I think it could be one or the other. I'm not saying it's always in another realm, but I think it can be. And I think that some of the messages that come through are coming from some other dimension, other world, even perhaps from another entity. I don't know. I mean, I can only say what I sense about this. I mean, one thing that was kind of was interesting to me as I did research into this was there were studies done of DMT, which is the main ingredient, chemical ingredient, I guess, in ayahuasca that you've mentioned. A lot more people have discovered and have experienced in Peru and now elsewhere with shamans. And it's a psychedelic and not for everybody, but DMT, it turns out, dimethyltryptamine, I believe it is found naturally in the human body. And in fact, they've done studies that show there is more DMT in the brains or bodies of people diagnosed with schizophrenia.
That's right.
DMT takes you on a definite out-of-body experience. And there were studies done by a MD named Rick Strassman in the 90s in a clinical setting, where people would come into his lab, and DMT was very quick. They would be given this, and it would about 8 or 10 minutes, and they would just zoom out there, and often, even this is weird, but they reported encounters with alien beings. And not just one person reported this, but a lot of people reported it. So hey, there's a lot of mysteries that we just don't know the answer to, but have to be, I think, open to in terms of stories like this.
You know what's so fascinating about that is I had heard that too, and I had read somewhere that like the number, I'll just throw out a random percentage, 5% of people have elevated levels of DMT in their body, And if you look at the number of people who claim that they've been abducted by aliens, it's virtually the exact same percentage. Mm-hmm. So one starts to think, okay, maybe there's a tie-in here because the percentages are the same, and people who take DMT report the same thing that these abductees report. Yep. So then the question becomes, all right, well, did this 5% of people that have elevated levels of DMT, were they, again, as I ask, is this their imagination, or did they really have an experience? Were they really abducted? Did they really see aliens? Did they move into another realm? And one thing I wanted to ask you about was, it seems to me that, and this is very strange, you and I, I'm sure, both dreamed last night, mm-hmm. and I guarantee we dreamed of something different. Guaranteed.
Yep.
And, you know, some people will say, oh, you should never take, I never take NyQuil because I have the craziest dreams. And other people will say the same thing, but they never have the same dreams. Whereas with these experiences, you're right. People very often report the exact same thing. And it depends on the drug, too. Like, some people talk about they see the elves or the aliens or whatever. And other people with other drugs, they all see this lizard. And I find it very strange that, what does that mean? That you're all seeing the same thing? I mean, if it's all in your brain, shouldn't really everybody see something different? Because that's how it is with normal dreaming and nightmares and such. It's always different for people, but not with these drugs.
Yeah, well, you know, there is a collective unconscious also, which, you know, Jung has spoken about, written about, and Hillman and other post-Jungian thinkers. And, you know, the collective unconscious is the, we swim in it, you know, it surrounds us. It's, you know, we can tap into it. We can have dreams that reflect it. And it's, you know, it's universal. I mean, it's big. And so who knows? I mean, these experiences that people are having may be tapping into that. And that may have to do also with a much larger universe than we can see every day. Certainly when we dream, we go into that world. You know, it's an underworld. It's close to dying, as close as we're going to get. You know, we do it, you know, every night. So, and we always dream. Everybody dreams. So that's fascinating stuff. And I've been delving into it in my studies and writing this biography of James Hillman as well, who was the founder of what's called archetypal psychology. Very strong emphasis on mythology and on the importance of the aesthetic and of imagination, the importance of the human imagination, which, you know, these days often gets given a short shrift, gets lost in our completely material culture.
Well, I could ask you questions for years, but we're running low on time. I do have one more, however, and feel free to plead the fifth or say you read the book if this is actually a spoiler for My Mysterious Son. But in your travels, running into other shamans and such, I would presume that at some point the opportunity arose to experiment with whether it be ayahuasca or whatever and enter into a realm where maybe, as you are there and with your son, you guys are communicating with each other on the same wavelength. Has anything like that ever happened?
No, it hasn't. I mean, I never have gone there, which is not to say that I wouldn't, but at this point, I haven't. And, you know, I'm getting older. I'm not so sure if I want to dive back into the psychedelic world. I mean, I did do some of that when I was young, and so I haven't intentionally avoided it. It just hasn't really happened. But I've been able to have enough experiences through what my son has taught me, just about the dimension that he lives in and the some of the time, and the sort of moving between through time and space and between past and present and future, that has been instructive, let me say. Once I took it seriously, and I do take it very seriously.
Three great books here by Dick Russell. He's actually written nearly a dozen. If you're interested in the discussion we had about the gray whales, you can check out Eye of the Whale, Epic Passage from Baja to Siberia, available on Amazon.com. If you love the discussion about JFK, They killed our president. 63 reasons to believe there was a conspiracy to assassinate JFK. Also available on Amazon with co-author Jesse Ventura. And if you were interested in the talk we just had here about schizophrenia, shamanism, psychedelic drugs, you can check out My Mysterious Son, a life-changing passage between schizophrenia and shamanism. All of these available at Amazon.com. Most of them available on the Kindle. I don't think Eye of the Whale is. I could be wrong. But I want to make sure I give you, Dick, a chance to plug anything else that you'd like, your website, if you've got any social media, whatever you'd like to get out there, or anything else that you think that I didn't mention but people really should read.
Well, thank you, Brian. Well, my website is www.dickrussell2s2ls.org. There's a lot more on there about my environmental work and about all my different books and experiences with Ventura and with the Kennedy assassination. So people are welcome to check that out, and I've really enjoyed talking with you today.
DickRussell.org, R-U-S-S-E-L-L, I attempted to say, DickRussell.org and Amazon.com. And Dick, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today. I had a great time, and hopefully we can do it again sometime. And of course,
me too. Yes, I would enjoy that, and thanks so much.
And of course, we'll be back in just a moment with more, everybody, After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio, live on Friday night. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Every Friday night, 11 Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern, we are live. Of course, replays on Saturday. If you missed any portion of that great interview there with a very fascinating fella, Dick Russell, it is going to be available as a free download a few minutes after the show goes off the air up at our website, afterdarkradioshow.com. Make sure you head up there to the website and check that out. You can already download last week's show with Carl Stern talking the Roswell slides and more, but this interview will be up there tomorrow. It'll also be replaying throughout the day Saturday on the Dark Matter Radio Network. So if you happen to be listening to this on a replay, now you know when you can listen to the show live every Friday at night, 11 Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern, until, I guess, July. As soon as Art Bell takes over the 9 to midnight time slot, I'll be moving to midnight. But until then, 11 p.m. is the time slot here for After Dark Radio. If you want to give us a call, the lines are open. What did you think of the Dick Russell interview? We can talk about that, the Roswell slides, anything that is on your mind. For example, on Twitter here, Jason from BC is asking me once again about canned water. Running out of time, he says. Time is short. So if you want to call about that, Jason, or whatever else is on your mind, you are welcome to 855-478-4478 is the phone number. That is 855-478-4478. All of these lines toll-free anywhere in the U.S. and Canada. Taking phone calls starting here in just a moment. I got a lot of very interesting news articles to read as well here this evening. You can send me emails. Brian at afterdarkradioshow.com. Although Brian at wrestlingobserver.com works as well. So however you want to contact me is however you want to contact me. Let's go to the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
It's Ed in San Antonio.
Yes, Ed.
I have a story for you, Brian. Something that happened to me the other night when I was going to go do my paper out. I should probably be dead in the gutter somewhere, but luckily I got lucky. I had gone to work at UPS, and then when UPS is over, I go, I pick up my newspapers. It's pretty much downtown, and then I go deliver my papers. Well, I had picked them up. I had rolled some of them. I was driving to my route. When I can see on the side of the road, one of the side streets while I'm driving, I can see a lady, like, waving her arms and yelling. And being the stupid person that I am, I actually turned back to see if this person needed help or what was going on. I didn't think it was a streetwalker because usually they don't try and wave you down. So I was going to see if she actually needed help. So I pull up to the side, and then I roll down my window, and I'm like, do you need help? Do you need to use your phone or something? And she's like, well, my car broke down down a few blocks ago. I just need to go down to this one street, Hackberry, which is like 5 blocks away. It's not too far. So I was like, I'll give you a ride, no problem. So I had her sit in the back.
Oh, man, that was the beginning of the end right there, dude.
Yeah, well, I had her sit in the back because I got all my papers and stuff in the front. And she gets in the car, and she's real super nice, and she's talking very coherent. and clearly, and everything's cool. And then she kind of starts to ramble a little bit, and then she goes right into freaking demon voice and starts like talking in tongues, and starts like as like exorcist, who's got this real deep rah, and she's making all these sounds, and I'm just like, what the hell is going on here? And then I'm almost there, and then about a block away, I come to a street where there's like a train that's just stopped. So basically, I'm kind of like in a dead end, and I got this girl, and then she really starts talking in this like demon voice, and I don't know what the hell is going on. So I'm actually terrified. So finally, I just made my way back around, got to the street where she wanted to go to, and finally she got off. She like got out, and then she had the door open for like the longest time trying to talk to me, and I'm trying to go, but you know, either I was talking to a lady who was possessed or a streetwalker who was tripping out on PCP or something, but it was literally like one of the scariest things I've ever dealt with it doing the paper out. And I've seen some crazy stuff doing the paper out over the tank, over the years. So yeah, it was it was scary. Like I say, it was like sitting next to like the exorcist girl, because she sounded just like that pretty much.
Just in the middle of the drive, she started talking in tongues.
Yeah, I swear to God, she just like started making all these weird noises and then started kind of like cussing in the tongues. And then the weird thing is, she all of a sudden she'd go back to being totally normal and coherent. And she'd talk for like a little while, and then she'd start making these weird noises again and weird sounds and weird, super deep, scary voices, man. It was like I say, it was like I kind of kept my eye to the side because I was waiting for like a knife to come flying at me or something. But luckily,
I'm fascinated. You kept driving and didn't just pull over and say, "Get out of my car."
Well, I figured if I didn't, like I say, she was in the back. I didn't want to get out of the car, and then she jumps in the front and takes off in my car. So it was like, plus, like I say, I didn't know she had a weapon or something. So I figured if I try to throw the person out, you know, she could stab me or pull out a gun or something. So I was trying to be as nice as possible, and figured that would be the best action, that where I don't make her freak out so she tries to freaking kill me. So,
well, Ed, I hope you learned a valuable lesson.
Yeah, I doubt I'm going to be picking anybody up off the streets for a while, no matter what they look like or what I think's going on.
No, let's not pick anybody up anymore, Ed. I want to thank you very much for a great call, and I'd like to hear more stories about strange things you've seen on your paper route. Ed has a paper route, which of course he does in the late night hours. And if you've been driving around the late night hours, you know what weird things there are to see. Sometimes I'm a big fan of radio. I know that will come as a shocker to everybody here, but I love listening to radio shows. And sometimes at night, I will just leave my house and I'll drive around and I'll listen to the radio. Don't even ask me why I don't like to do it sitting at home, but I guess when I was younger, and actually, this is probably what it was. When I was younger, I used to listen to Art Bell, and he came on at night, and I wanted to listen to it on the radio, obviously, and I didn't really have much of a radio in my house, and so I would drive around and listen to Art Bell. So I think that to this day, I just find it very relaxing to drive around at night and listen to the radio. So I have driven around many a night listening to various radio shows, and I haven't ever had an experience like that, but, you know, you see animals. I've seen all sorts of, you see rabbits, I've seen coyotes, I've seen deer, and I don't live in a really rural area, but it is cool to see the animals, that's number one. And I have seen just weird people out there. I remember that one time I was driving down this, I don't want to say it was like a deserted road or anything like that, but it's a little ways out there. And I just remember driving and my headlights picked up somebody who was walking on the side of the road. And as I got closer, I mean, this was just the scariest looking thing I've ever seen. Just like, it was like a scene out of a monster movie. I mean, I don't know what it really was, but in my brain, it was like all these tattered clothes and long hair. It looked like a zombie. And I mean, the moment I saw whatever this was, I mean, my heart just, you know, when your heart just like skips a beat and you're just like, oh my God, what is that? And I zoomed on past it and I was just like, my heart was racing. And so I actually did this giant loop so that I could get back to where I was and drive by again, and never saw it again, whatever or whoever it was. But man, that scared the bejesus out of me. And then, this is just like weird, but this is like a couple of weeks ago. I was driving and I was just driving down this road in a neighborhood, and there was a camper. And as I started to get close to the camper, my headlight started to illuminate it, and it looked like there were people in it, like driving it, except it wasn't driving. It was parked on the, like outside somebody's house, and it was the nothing, no lights on, nothing. It was just like it was parked there, but it appeared that there were people sitting there like they would be driving it. And so I was like, this is kind of weird. Why are there people in this thing here? It had to have been like, I don't know, 12:30 in the morning or something like that, midnight. So I started getting closer, closer. And as I drive by, it was like tigers, like tigers in there. And I thought I was out of my mind. I was like, what? And again, you know, your heart starts racing because it's like, what did I just see? I drove by this parked camper and there's tigers in it that appear to be like sitting there like they'd be driving. And so I looped around. And this time when I went back, there were in fact tigers there. I don't know what they were, but somebody had like put these big stuffed animals in the passenger seat and the driver's seat of this camper on the side of the road. And I don't know why they did it. They must have thought it was funny, but it scared the bejesus out of me. So yes, strange things occur when you drive around in the middle of the night. 855-478-4478 is the phone number if you want to call in toll free in the U.S. and Canada. That is 855-478-4478. Jason, who was asking about the canned water on Twitter, Joshua here says, wasn't there supposed to be an EMP attack by now? And Jason says, it is coming. I would plan to be at home with plenty of canned water, jerky, weapons, and canned goods by July 4th, he says. And he says, if your neighbors see your canned water, just be aware that they will be coming to murder you after the EMP attack. He also says, Brian, are you sure you had not been smoking some funny cigars before you saw those tigers? No, I wasn't. They're still there right now. They are real stuffed animal tigers. That is legitimate. And I know my neighbors, by the way, and they're not coming over here to kill me. That's just not happening. I'm sure that we can work something out. Which reminds me, by the way, before I get into the news stories here today, I teach a jujitsu class for kids, and we were doing class the other day, and there were these two little kids, and we make them grapple. We like have them play these games where like one person is in the mount, and the person on the bottom has to try and escape, and the person on top has to try and hold them down, then you switch. And anyway, a lot of these kids will just like go in there and grapple like little wild beasts, but there were two kids, both five. And I sat one kid on top of the other, and I said, okay, you're going to play the mount game. Person on the bottom, escape. Person on top, I want you to try and hold him down. And I said, Ray said, go. And the little kid on the bottom just goes, can we talk this out? That was his defense. Can we talk this out? Anyway, we've got this here, exploring the link, as I noted, between autism and anomalous experiences. You can read that at the Epic Times, theepictimes.com. Also, this, very fascinating. The universe, a Matrix computer game designed by aliens, says NASA, which is a little bit of an exaggeration. That's not exactly NASA saying this. A British philosopher, Nick Bostrom, says he believes that the reality we perceive around us may be the product of a highly advanced computer program, much like the plot of the Matrix movies. And surprisingly, it says, NASA have said they agree with him. Dr. Bostrom proposed in a paper he wrote that an evolved race of humans have imprisoned the human race in what he refers to as a digital imprisonment. These aliens, or superhumans, are using virtual reality to simulate space and time. NASA scientist Rich Terrell, director of the Center for Evolutionary Computation and Automated Design at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, thinks Dr. Bostrom may be onto something. Speaking to Vice, the NASA scientist said, "Right now, the fastest NASA supercomputers are cranking away at about double the speed of the human brain. If you make a simple calculation using Moore's Law, which roughly, it says here, claims computers double in processing power every 2 years, you will find that these supercomputers inside of one decade, 10 years, will have the ability to compute an entire human lifetime of 80 years, including every thought ever conceived during that lifetime, in the span of a month." Express.co.uk reports, "In quantum mechanics, particles do not have a definite state unless they are being observed. Many theorists have spent a lot of time trying to figure out how you can explain this. One explanation is that we are living within a simulation, seeing what we need to see when we need to see it. What I find inspiring is that even if we are in a simulation or many orders of magnitude down in levels of simulation, somewhere along the line, something escaped the primordial ooze to become us and to result in simulations that made us, and that is cool. The idea of our universe as a fiction generated by computer code solves a number of inconsistencies and mysteries about the cosmos. The first is the Fermi paradox, posed by physicist Enrico Fermi during the 1960s, which highlights the contradiction between the apparent high probability of extraterrestrial civilizations within our ever-expanding universe and humanity's lack of contact with, or lack of evidence for, these alien colonies. Fermi asked, where is everybody? It could simply be that Earth and mankind truly is the center of this universe. Another mystery explained by the Matrix-like theory is the role of dark matter, and we're not talking the digital network here. U.S. theoretical cosmologist Michael Turner has called the hypothetical material the most profound mystery in all of science. Dark matter is one of many hypothetical materials used to explain a number of anomalies in the Standard Model, which is the all-encompassing theory science has used to explain the particles and forces of nature for the last 50 years. Standard Model of Particle Physics tells us there are 17 fundamental particles which make up atomic matter. The Higgs boson, which was first theorized by scientists during the 60s, is among the 17 fundamental particles. They essentially say the Standard Model is as yet unable to explain a number of baffling properties of the universe, including the fact that the universe is expanding at an ever-increasing speed. And this, he says, and others say, is proof that perhaps our universe is a simulation. However, Professor Peter Millikan, who teaches philosophy and computer science at Oxford University, thinks the virtual reality explanation is flawed. He says the theory seems to be based on the assumption that super minds would do things in much the same way that we do. If they think this world is a simulation, then why do they think that super minds, who would be outside the simulation, would be constrained by the same sorts of thoughts and methods that we are? They assume the ultimate structure of a real world can't be grid-like, and also that the superminds would have to implement a virtual world using grids. We can conclude that a grid structure is evidence of a pretend reality just because our ways of implementing a pretend reality involve a grid. You got that? Essentially, he says, it is an interesting idea, and it is healthy to have some crazy ideas. So, a little bit of a stretch to say that NASA says that the universe is a matrix computer designed by aliens. One NASA scientist says it's a possibility. Interesting headline, but still a very, very interesting theory there. NASA solves the mystery of the bright spots on Ceres. This from unexplained-mysteries.com, linked up at afterdarkradioshow.com. If you have not been paying attention, the enigmatic dwarf planet Ceres, the largest object in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, has a strange bright spot on its surface. And people have been trying to figure out, what is this? Why is there a bright spot? It's real. It's not some sort of glitch in the digital photography. What is this? And according to Unsolved, Unexplained-Mysteries here, As NASA's Dawn spacecraft approached the enigmatic dwarf planet, one of the first things that caught people's attention was a mysterious bright spot inside a crater on its surface. Now, at last, NASA has been able to determine that these peculiar features are actually the result of sunlight reflecting off of something highly reflective on the planet's surface. Well, we knew that. I hope we have more information than that. What is it? What is reflecting sunlight on the surface of this dwarf planet here? And by the way, for those of you that think that NASA might be covering up evidence of extraterrestrial life, when strange bright lights appeared on this dwarf planet, these were not covered up. I mean, if I saw strange bright lights on a planet, I would presume that maybe that was a sign of civilization there. Maybe it was a gigantic city. Who knows what was putting off that light? So NASA did not cover this up. In fact, they enlisted the help of the public. What do you think this is? What are your theories? What could this be? And new images taken of Ceres have revealed that the two most prominent bright spots are actually made up of several smaller ones, and that the whole surface appears to be littered with them. And there's a photograph here of Ceres spinning, and you can see the bright light spinning with the planet. Dawn scientist, it says, can now conclude that the intense brightness of the spots is due to the reflection of sunlight by highly reflective material on the surface, possibly ice. Still a lot of work to do to confirm what the reflective material indeed is, but NASA scientists are hoping that Dawn will provide the information they need over the coming months. So, there's your answer. What is interesting is, as it turns, as Ceres turns, you don't see the bright spots dimming or getting brighter. They stay at a consistent brightness. I don't know if that means that the sun is just coincidentally in the perfect spot to illuminate them the whole time, or if they're perhaps self-illuminating. Wouldn't that be interesting? What would that mean? This is also interesting. This is from artbell.com. Non-human horrific radio broadcast kills power to Navy ship. It says here there's something innately terrifying about the open water. Even now, centuries after man created maps showing monsters at the edge of the world, much of the planet's oceans continue to remain unexplored, holding secrets that can often frighten even the most seasoned sailor, such as the case with a story shared this morning by a man with a decade of service in the United States Navy, and the horrific encounter with what he believes was an inhuman intelligence that cut his ship's power and took over the high-frequency airwaves, spreading communications that crawled under his skin. In 10 years of service, he says he's never heard anything like it. He never wants to again. This man told Reddit, I've been in the U.S. Navy for almost a decade. I'm currently on my third deployment to the Western Pacific. I work on communications equipment and spend a fair amount of time just scanning different frequencies to see what I come across. A couple of years back, we were 30 to 40 nautical miles off the coast of the Philippines. It was just over the horizon. And the ship lost power. Lights, engines, everything just went silent. I don't want to say this is regular, but it's happened enough throughout my career that it doesn't bother me half as much as it should. So the power's out, emergency lights are on, and the UPS are keeping communications up till the engineers can get the power back up. I'm doing my usual scanning hi-fi frequencies for anything coming out of the PI when my receiver starts picking up the most awful, interesting, horrific sounds I have ever heard in my life. I have heard all types of interference. It was not that. I've heard people trying to go over an encrypted circuit without crypto, and it wasn't that. It raised the hair on my neck and arms and made me feel very, very small. It felt like I was sitting there for hours while these sounds crawled under my skin, like I was traveling through the warp without a Geller field. After about 5 minutes, it suddenly stopped, and the power came back on. I will never forget the sounds that I heard. And I thought it was interesting, this one today, because my story is not the same, but I was in the car today and I was getting ready to get out and my wife called and I've got Bluetooth in the car. And so I hit the answer button and I could not hear her and she could not hear me. And we did the old, hello, can you hear me? Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? And essentially neither of us could apparently hear each other. So I hit the hang up button, and the moment I hit the hang up button, I just heard, I don't know what this guy heard, but I imagine it was similar to what I heard. Just this horrible screeching. I can't even explain what I heard coming through my car speakers. I don't know what happened to my phone, but it was just like screeching, howling, wailing, this terrible noise. I had to shut the car off to get it to stop. And then I came up here to artbell.com and read that article, and I thought, man, what a coincidence. And finally here, in the I don't know if this is a good idea category, it seems that chicken embryos with dinosaur snouts have been created in the lab. You can read about it at livescience.com. With a little molecular tinkering, for the first time, scientists have created chicken embryos with broad velociraptor-like muzzles in place of beaks. The bizarrely developing chickens shed new light on how the bird's beak evolved. Yes, they have created birds with velociraptor-like muzzles instead of beaks. I once had a chicken. We had a bunch of chickens. We had a rooster named Henry, and he was a holy terror, and he attacked all my friends, and he attempted to kill us, and if he would have had a velociraptor-like muzzle, we would all be dead. So I don't know if this is a good idea, but this article is up at livescience.com. Chicken embryos with dinosaur snouts have, in fact, been created in the lab. We're pretty much out of time here today, everybody, but I want to thank everybody for listening. As noted, we are here every Friday night, 11 Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern, Dark Matter Radio Network. We air every Friday, replays on Saturday. If you missed any portion of this show, a replay is going to be up in about 15 minutes at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. I, of course, want to thank my guest today, Dick Russell, for an amazing interview. And, of course, all of you for listening as well. Please support the Dark Matter Radio Network, ArtBell.com. When Art's getting ready to come back and the subscription area opens up, hopefully everybody will support that because that'll help keep Art Bell on the air for the foreseeable future. DarkMatterRadio.net is the website address. All sorts of great shows playing there. I've got the Dark Matter Radio Network on my TuneIn Radio app on my smartphone, which I use with Bluetooth in my car, and drive around at night and listen to the Dark Matter Radio Network. What could be better? So check that out. We're going to be back next week with a brand new show. Until then, check out artbell.com, afterdarkradio.com. Huge thank you to Dick Russell, our illustrious webmaster, Keith Rowland, and the great Art Bell as well. And of course, all of you, thanks again for listening tonight. After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network.